you guys, it's time for another movie review. Now, just like the last regular episode of 13 O'Clock, this is going to be just me because Tom is still out of town. I'm recording this on Wednesday. I'm going to put it up on Friday. Now, he should be back in town Friday night, so the night that this comes up. So from now on, he should be back on the show. But, you know, he's just been gone and he's been taking care of his family stuff and everything like that. And I really, really appreciate everybody that has sent me messages and commented on the YouTube videos with their best wishes about his dad and stuff like that. His dad has had the surgery. It went fine. They're, you know, just waiting to see what the recovery process is going to be like and everything like that. But it seems like the worst of it has passed. So we'll see how it goes. And like I said, Tom will be back on Friday night. So from now on, that he should be back on the show in the ensuing episodes. So since Tom is not here, I decided to do a movie review on actually one of my favorite movies of all time, but one that Tom has actually not seen, but he's generally not crazy about David Lynch movies in general. So I decided, well, I'll just put this one in the can while he's not here, and then I don't have to make him watch it, and he'll be like, that's so stupid. You know what I mean? It won't be like that. So I'm actually going to do Mulholland Drive from 2001. Now, not only is this easily my favorite David Lynch movie, it's also in my top 10 favorite movies ever. And apparently I'm not the only one with that opinion. When it came out in 2001, it actually premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, and David Lynch won the Best Director Prize that year. And subsequently, Mulholland Drive has gone on to win numerous accolades, tons and tons of different film magazines and film critics and stuff like that have ranked Mulholland Drive as, you know, the best movie of the 2000s. And it's ended up on lots and lots of critics, like best movies ever list and stuff like that. Even though it does have its detractors, like all David Lynch movies do, because, you know, surrealism in film is just one of those things that you like it or you think it's a bunch of bullshit, you know. So where you stand on that, I'm not making a judgment or anything like that. I tend to really like it. I think probably the most common criticism that people leveled at Mulholland Drive and David Lynch movies in general is that it doesn't make any sense and all this other stuff. Now, I am here to argue with you that this movie absolutely does make sense, but you have to see it a couple of times. It's really, it operates on a lot of subtext and symbolism and things like that, and you really have to be paying attention. And really, you don't know what's going on for the first three quarters of the movie until you see the last quarter of the movie, at which point you should probably start over and watch it all over again, and then you'll be like, oh, okay, now I understand. So I'm going to get into that. I'm going to recommend right here, because I'm a total dork about this movie, and I'm like not even ashamed of that. So there is a site that is just called mulhollanddrive.net, I think. Yeah, mulhollanddrive.net with a dash in between Mulholland and Drive. And it is like the world's most obsessive website about Mulholland Drive. It has this huge, huge essay by Alan Shaw, which I'm going to be referring to a lot because I think he really kind of nailed everything in this movie. And it's super, super long and it's super detailed. So, you know, I'm only going to get into a little bit of it, but if you're really, really interested in this movie or you really love this movie as much as I do, then I would recommend going to the site and read it. It's a long read, but it's totally worth it. And I think he totally nailed it. But there's also tons of links to like Reddit threads and stuff like that with other people's theories and stuff like that, because Mulholland Drive is a movie that's kind of open to interpretation. In general, though, I think the narrative structure of it is pretty cut and dried. Within that structure, I think there's like little details that might be different or you can have your own theories about and stuff like that. But overall, I think it's a pretty straightforward narrative. Now, it's actually interesting to me that this movie came out as brilliant as it came out because I don't know if a lot of you know this, but it was actually intended to be a television series, a la Twin Peaks. So actually, David Lynch wrote and shot scenes for the pilot in 1999, and he pitched it to ABC executives. They had actually asked him to do it because they like Twin Peaks, and they're like, okay, well, we'll do another thing like that. So this actually started as a TV series. Now, after The executive saw the rough cuts or saw the pilot or whatever. They're like, no, we don't like that. It's too weird, which I thought was strange because it's like, it's David Lynch, for Christ's sake. What did you expect? So they didn't like it. So I guess David Lynch was kind of bummed out. And he's like, well, I like this idea and stuff like that. So he decided to shoot extra stuff and kind of close in the narrative and make it a feature film, which was released in 2001. Now, so I have seen some critics of this film argue that, well, you can really tell that this was supposed to be a TV series because there were all these like unrelated plot threads that weren't resolved, or there was like all these scenes with characters that you didn't see again and stuff like that. And, you know, obviously he was intending to finish up that storyline and he never got to it because he didn't get to do the series. But I would actually argue that that is incorrect. I don't think there's anything in this movie that wasn't really resolved. I know that when you're watching it the first time, especially the first three quarters of it, there are a lot of scenes that feature characters that don't really turn up again or only turn up very briefly, like at the end, and they seem to not have anything to do with the main plot. But actually, the more times you watch it, the more you understand how everything interlocks and how everything fits together. So I don't think that he left anything hanging or anything like that. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit too. Now, another interesting thing too, since I mentioned Twin Peaks, evidently this series initially, the initial idea for it was supposed to be a spin-off series about Audrey Horne, the character that Sherilyn Fenn played on Twin Peaks. So this was going to be about her, like later on, I guess, in her life or whatever. That's what she says anyway. So that's kind of where they're going with it. Now, it's kind of hard to classify, as most of his movies are. It's kind of a psychological thriller, kind of a noir mystery type of thing. But it also has a lot of really surreal elements. It has a lot of dark comedy elements. Now, what I'm going to do, I think, because this is... I've been waiting to do this one for such a long time, and it's like so complex, and I have like all these zillion ideas like racing around in my head. So I apologize if this is like a little disjointed or goes off on tangents or whatever, because this is like a huge topic and I've read and thought a lot about this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you like a layout of what the plot seems to be. Then I'll kind of explain, I'll like go back and explain like what's actually going on. So on the surface, this movie appears to be about a dark-haired woman who is being driven somewhere in a limousine, and apparently she's in the limousine with these two guys in the front seat, and they're going to kill her, like she has a hit out on her. Now, before this happens, these teenagers who are like drag racing coming the other way smash into the limousine. There's a huge crash. Presumably, everyone is killed except for her. Now, she crawls out of the wreckage, and she's, you know, obviously disoriented and kind of hurt and stuff like that. But she manages to run away from the scene of the accident. Now, it turns out, we don't find out till later, but she has amnesia. She has no idea who she is. She doesn't know where she was going, what she was doing, why somebody was trying to kill her, anything like that. So she ends up hiding in an apartment that is kind of left open because this woman is going out of town. Like, you can see her door open and like the cab driver's bringing all her luggage out and stuff like that. So it's obvious she's going to be gone a long time. So while the mover is going in and out, this dark-haired woman sneaks into the apartment and kind of hides in there so she has a place to stay. Now, it turns out that this apartment belongs to a woman we only know as Aunt Ruth. And Aunt Ruth has given her niece, Betty, who we are introduced to in a little while, she's played by Naomi Watts, she's given her some money and given her this apartment to stay in while she's gone so she can come to LA and be a big star, like, because that's what her dream is. So when Betty arrives in LA and arrives at the apartment, she meets this mysterious, glamorous stranger. And, you know, as they discuss things and it comes to pass and everything like that, she says she doesn't remember who she is and stuff like that. All she has on her, she's wearing like a black party dress and she has a purse. And importantly, inside the purse, there's no ID or anything like that. All that is in the purse is a shit ton of money in cash and a blue key. Now, the woman who takes the name Rita from a poster for the movie Gilda, which had Rita Hayworth in it, that's on the aunt's apartment wall. So she suspects that she is in some kind of trouble or that people are after her or something like that. Now, her and Betty strike up a friendship. which eventually turns into a sexual relationship. And the main part of the narrative is the two of them trying to figure out Rita's real identity and what this money is and what this key is and stuff like that. Now, as this narrative goes on, there are also some seemingly unrelated interludes. The other main part of this involves a director, a film director named Adam Kesher. And he is evidently being forced by what appears to be the mob to replace the lead actress in the movie that he's working on with an actress of their choosing. So he's seen at a meeting with these two like mobbed up dudes, and they're just like, they give him this picture and they say, you know, this is the girl and you have to put her in the movie. And at first, he flips out and he doesn't want to do it. This is his movie. And, you know, how dare they tell him what to do and stuff like that. And so you kind of follow Adam Kesher as he has this just ridiculously horrible day, like, because the mobsters tell him, you have to put this girl in the movie. And he says, no, I'm not going to do it. It's my movie. He goes and he fucks up their limousine, the two mobster brothers. Then he goes back to his house because he's so pissed off, and he finds his wife in bed with the pool man, Gene Clean, which I kind of love. And his wife kicks him out of his own house because he's the asshole, evidently. And, you know, he's got pink paint all over him, all this other stuff. It's just all this crazy shit happens. So then later on, it turns out that because of the shit he did with the mobsters, they have somehow been able to cut off all his money. So he is broke. So he ends up staying at this kind of flop house hotel that's run by this guy named Cookie and all this other kind of stuff. So that stuff is going on along with the Betty and Rita trying to find out Rita's identity thing. Now, there are also a couple of other scenes in there that really seem like they don't belong. One of these is a hitman who turns up in this office. We don't know who he is. We don't know who the guy he's talking to is. And they're just talking and kind of joking around and stuff like that. And the hitman shoots him. And then it turns out that he accidentally shot through the wall, and he shot this other woman in the next apartment through the wall, like in her stomach. She's a big fat woman. And so he has to go over there and kill her. And then someone else sees it and he has to kill them too. And like, it's just this farcical kind of scene, like this bumbling hitman. Now, evidently, the whole, we're not really sure what his mission is, but he was evidently just supposed to kill the first guy that was sitting at the desk and steal this black book. Now, we don't really know what's in the black book or why he needed it or anything like that. So there's that scene. There's also some scenes with the gangsters and with this mysterious guy named Mr. Roque, who's played by the little person actor that also played the little person from the Red Room in Twin Peaks. He doesn't move and he only has like two lines. He looks like he's strapped in this wooden chair, and they actually built him like normal size, like prosthetic arms. So it would make his head look really small, because you know how David Lynch loves to make everything look grotesque and stuff like that. And this guy is just like behind glass, and people only talk to him like through an intercom. No one really says who this is, but he's supposed to be like the guy that's behind it all or something like that. Now, the other scene that I want to talk about, and I'm going to get more into this later, because this scene here, even though it involves characters that seemingly don't have anything else to do with the plot, I think this scene is almost like the movie's mission statement, or like an abstract of a scientific paper. It's kind of like the fulcrum of the entire thing, that kind of like the key that explains it all. And the scene I'm talking about is the very famous Winky's Diner scene between the two guys who are talking about, one of the guys is telling the other guy about a dream he's had about this horrible monster behind the diner, and all this other stuff. So I'm going to get into that a little bit later, because like I said, I think that's kind of important. So all this stuff is going on at the beginning. Now, there's a scene near the end of this first part where Rita and Betty go to a theater called Club Silencio. And while they're in there, it's like this really bizarre show about like a guy coming out and saying, you know, there's no band, everything is an illusion and all this other stuff. And after that performance, Betty opens her handbag and there's a blue box in there that seems to match the blue key that Rita had. So now when they get back to the apartment, they decide they're going to open this blue box with the blue key. But when that happens, they get the blue box in the room. She puts it down on the bed and then suddenly she's gone. She disappears. And Rita is like looking for her and doesn't know where she went. Now, Rita opens the blue box with the blue key and is seemingly sucked into it. There's just blackness. Now, after this part, this is where the final fourth of the movie begins. And I think people, like I said, if you don't know what's going on in this, this is going to seem very confusing to you, because after the whole thing with the blue box opening, after that point, you see the same actors, but now their names are all switched, like their identities are all switched, and all this different shit is going on. So here's where I'm going to kind of explain what's going on. Okay. Now, one of the best analogs to Mulholland Drive to understand its narrative structure is The Wizard of Oz. Now, David Lynch has kind of an affinity with Wizard of Oz. He's used, actually, in Wild at Heart from 1990, he used a lot of Wizard of Oz imagery, like blatantly. Laura Dern's mom shows up as the Wicked Witch of the West at one point on the bicycle and everything. And at the end of it, I think it's Cheryl Lee. She's playing Glinda the Good Witch, and she comes down in a bubble, like telling Sailor, who's Nicolas Cage, that he should go back to Lula and all this other kind of stuff. So he has a thing for that movie and has used imagery from it in a lot of his other movies. Now, this one, the Wizard of Oz connection, I think, is less obvious, but the overarching structure of the movie is very, very similar to The Wizard of Oz, because the final fourth of the movie represents the real life of the character Diane Selwyn, played by Naomi Watts. Now, she has been seen as Betty in the first part of the movie. So what we're seeing now, okay, I'm going to say right here that some people will argue, okay, so the first three quarters of this is a dream or a fantasy vision of Diane Selwyn's. Now, some people have argued that the last part of it is also a dream, or, you know, it's a dream within a dream, but whatever. It's not really that important. Now, I would argue that the last fourth of the movie is not it doesn't represent necessarily objective reality, because we're still seeing things through Diane Selwyn's perceptions. So, you know, though I think it's kind of sort of reality, or sort of what really happened, it's probably colored by her own perceptions and her own mental state and things like that. But that's not really here nor there. In general, the last part of the movie is real life. The first three quarters of the movie is a dream or a fantasy that she has constructed in order to deal with something terrible that she has done. Like, she's trying to work it out in her mind. Now, like I said, this is very similar to The Wizard of Oz, because in The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy is very unhappy and she thinks somebody loves her and Miss Gulch is going to kill her dog and all this other kind of stuff. So she decides to run away. And then during the tornado, she gets knocked out, she falls asleep, and she has this vivid fantasy where she recasts people from her real life into her dream, but they're all aspects of her persona. And she's trying to work out her own, like, emotional issues by using these other people in these other roles. So Mulholland Drive is very similar. So at the end of the movie, in the last quarter of the movie, we see the character we've known as Betty, we now find out is Diane Selwyn. Now, Diane Selwyn has come to LA, and unlike in the first part of the movie, her career hasn't been going so well. She hasn't really been getting much work. There is implications that she may have had to work as a prostitute to make ends meet, things of that nature. Like, a lot of this is, like I said, you're not going to get this from the first reading of the film necessarily, because a lot of this is in the subtext and in the details and in the symbolism and references to other movies that David Lynch has added and things like that. But the implication being that she came here, it's not going so well. She's kind of living in sort of a crappy apartment. And at some point, she got into a relationship with the glamorous dark-haired actress, who in her fantasy was an amnesiac and was named Rita, but in real life is named Camilla Rhodes, which is actually the name of a blonde woman in her fantasy that she saw auditioning for another role. And that will kind of come into play later too. Now, her and Camilla got into a relationship and perhaps lived together at some point. And Diane was way more into Camilla than Camilla was into her. Now, Camilla is very foxy, very vampy, you know, she ends up getting a lot more parts and a lot better parts than Diane is getting. And the implication is that she might have been sleeping around to get them, or was willing to do so. Or at least that's how Diane perceived it. So Rita Starr is rising now, or Camilla rather. Now, Camilla gets a role in a big film, and she kind of throws Diane a bone and gives her like a little extra or like a background role or something like that. Now, on this film, she meets Adam Kesher, the director who we saw in the beginning of the movie, and those two start a relationship. So at some point, there is a conflict where Diane desperately wants to hang on to Camilla, but Camilla does not really love her and does not want to hang around. She wants to go marry Adam and, you know, get up in all the Hollywood starlet business and everything like that. So she breaks up with Diane. Now, Diane does not take this too well, obviously, because she's become obsessed with Camilla and actually, in a way, kind of wants to be her. So later on, there's actually a party. Now, after the breakup, Camilla calls Diane and says, you know, oh, come to this party. I want you to come. Now, Diane, perhaps naively, thinks this is because Camilla is sorry and wants to get back with her and stuff like that. Now, Camilla sends a limousine to pick Diane up. Now, Diane gets in the limousine and she's going up to a house on Mulholland Drive. Now, this is interesting because this scene here at the end of the movie is an analog to the scene at the very beginning of the movie where, quote unquote, Rita was in the limousine. She got stopped. The hitman turned around and turned a gun on her. She said, you know, we don't stop here. What's going on? And then there was a big car accident. So in this iteration, Diane is being driven up to the party, which is on Mulholland Drive. And the car stops and she says the same thing that Rita said at the beginning. She says, what are you doing? We don't stop here. But this time it turns out that Camilla has come down like this secret path from the house and she takes her by the hand and it's all magical and everything like that. Yeah, we're going to go up to the party and it's going to be wonderful and everything like that. Except then when she gets to the party, Camilla kind of humiliates her in front of everybody. Now, like I said, we're probably seeing this through Diane's perception. So I'm not sure how much of this can be trusted. Like, I'm not sure how cruel Camilla actually is, because if this is indeed how it happened, an objective reality, quote unquote, then Camilla's a bitch. I'm sorry. She's just a horrible, horrible Conti woman, because who would do this? I mean, she invites this woman that she once had a relationship to the party, kind of hinting, oh, maybe we'll get back together, maybe blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. And then she brings the girl back to the party and then proceeds to ignore her, announces her engagement to Adam, max on this other girl who is the same girl that Diane cast as Camilla Rhodes in her dream at the beginning of the movie, and basically just makes her feel like shit. So this is like the last straw, right? And Diane is not in the best mental state now anyway, not only because the breakup and everything like that, but also because, you know, her dreams of Hollywood stardom are really not working out the way she thought they would. So after the party, which is like her final humiliation, she goes to a hitman who, implication being that this is her pimp or someone that's associated with her pimp. Because in the dream at the beginning, or in the first portion of the movie, the dream portion of the movie, he's seen with a hooker, and the implication being that he's her pimp. And the hooker is not Naomi Watts, but it looks a lot like her. Like, she has like the short blonde hair and she has like a shirt. A same shirt that Diane/Betty wears later on. So the implication being that she's in her dream, she was like recasting that role that she did as someone else. So she's sitting at Winky's Diner in the same booth as the two guys from the beginning talking about the monster behind the diner. And she wants to hire a hitman to kill Camilla. So that does eventually come to pass. Now, the blue key is, the hitman shows her the blue key and he says, when it's done, you'll find this in the place I said. Okay? So the blue key is symbolic of the knowledge that Camilla is dead and that Diane was responsible for her death because she paid the hitman. This is also why Camilla/Rita's purse in the dream portion of the film was filled with money and had a blue key in it, because that was the knowledge, you know, that she had hired a hitman to kill Camilla. So the hit does go through. Or we presume, because Diane is seen in her shitty apartment and the blue key is on her coffee table as if she has picked it up. So from that point forward, She just starts to have a complete mental breakdown and stuff like that. Now, the final portion of the film, like I said, kind of represents reality. It's done almost kind of like, not really in the present, but it's done mostly in flashbacks so you can see what led up to this particular thing. Now, the point at which she's having the dream is probably after she has gotten the key, because the dream seems to be her trying to come to terms with the guilt of what she's done. And this is why I think the scene in Winky's diner is probably the most important one in the movie, in the sense that it's almost making like a meta statement about the movie as a whole. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the scene, which is actually one of the creepiest scenes in film ever. And I don't even know why. It's just the way it's shot, like the sound behind it. You know, it's just, there's something just really, really skin crawling about it. And David Lynch is really, really good at that. At that type of uncanny, like, you know, bringing up that kind of uncanny feeling. So in this scene, we're seeing a guy named Herb. I don't think he's named in the movie, but I'm pretty sure that's what his name is. And this other guy named Dan. Now, we don't know what the relationship between them is. It seems like Herb is Dan's therapist. So I'm kind of imagining, and like I said, the first part of the movie, you have to understand that none of these people are that way in real life. You're only seeing Diane's perception of them or Diane's recasting of them, because this is a whole dream or vision that she came up with in her mind. So even though these people might exist in reality, you are not seeing them as they really are. You're only seeing them as she perceives them. So I'm guessing that the Herb guy either represents her therapist or actually is her therapist. So Dan, who is apparently the patient. So I'm guessing that Dan represents Diane. Dan and Diane, very similar names. So I'm guessing that that's what that represents. Now, he is telling Herb that he wanted to come to this particular Winky's Diner, which is on Sunset Boulevard. And that's another lot of references that David Lynch makes in this movie. He makes a ton of references to Sunset Boulevard. It's really fun to actually pick up all the movie references, the references to other movies that he makes in this. He makes them to Sunset Boulevard, Ingmar Bergman's Persona. There's a bunch of other stuff in there. But, you know, like I said, a lot of that's on the website and you can look that up if you want. I won't go too much into it. But so Dan says, well, he wanted to come to this particular Winky's because he had a dream about it. He had two dreams about it, actually. He said, no, it looked just like this on the inside, but it wasn't day and it wasn't night. It was like a half night. So we're already, you know, this scene actually comes very, very early in the movie. It's only about 5 or 10 minutes into the movie. And I think, if I'm remembering it correctly, I just watched the film a couple of days ago again. I think it actually comes before Betty is even introduced. So, you know, like I said, this is kind of like the mission statement of the film. And already he's saying, I've had two dreams about this place. It was like half night, things like that. So you're already getting a hint that what you're seeing isn't real, you know, or it's a dream or a fantasy or whatever. And he says that, I mean, essentially he says, he's saying to the therapist, he says, you're in both dreams, you're scared. He says, then I realize that there's a man behind the wall. He's behind the wall, behind the diner. He's the one who's doing it. But he doesn't say what it is or anything like that. The therapist is like, so you wanted to come here to make sure that that guy wasn't behind there. Because he says the face is horrible. I hope I never see it outside of a dream. And it's been freaking him out, I guess. So he has come to this particular diner to kind of check and see if this horrible beast is behind the diner. The man who's doing it. I can see him through the wall, he says. So the therapist is like, okay, well, let's go check. Now, so they go and check behind the diner, and it will surprise no one to discover that there is a very horrible looking person behind the diner. At which point, Dan either faints or dies. It actually kind of looks like he dies, because it looks like Herb is like calling his name and like checking his pulse, and he's like, oh my God, he's dead or something like that. It doesn't really matter. But essentially, you're seeing this, it's a bum, really, a hobo that lives behind the diner. Now, I have seen this hobo. This hobo is symbolic. Now, the bum behind Winky's Diner, I've seen it said that it symbolizes failure, and maybe in part, but I don't think that's entirely accurate. What the bum behind the diner represents is the part of Diane that made her kill Camilla. So it's like, it's the deepest, darkest part of herself, the part she doesn't want anyone to know exists. So it represents her own evil. The reason why the bomb is behind the diner, I think, is because in real life, when Diane ordered the hit on Camilla and the hitman said, "I'll leave this blue key where I told you," I think the place where he left it was behind Winky's diner because they set up the hit in that same Winky's diner. So I'm imagining that he left the blue key behind the diner. So that's why I think the bum lives back there. And that's why I think that in Diane's dream at the beginning, she sees this man and he's terrified of something that's behind the diner, because that was the whole thing. She knew that when she went behind the diner and found that blue key, that meant Camilla was dead. So that was the final thing that she didn't want to face. And when Dan faced it in the fantasy portion of the film, he fainted or dropped dead. He couldn't deal with it. So it seems like the first part of the movie, the entire first part of the movie, is not only Diane trying to, not exactly trying to justify what she did. I think there is a little bit of that, but I think she's trying to come to terms with it, trying to almost absolve herself, maybe, because there's a lot of things going on in the fantasy portion of the film that kind of speak to her mental state at the time. It's fascinating that she recasts herself as Betty. Betty Elms is the name of the character, who is kind of this overly naive, chipper, stars in her eyes, kind of like golly gee whiz type of character, because in real life, she is, Diane is not like that at all. So I think she's trying to portray herself as this wide-eyed, naive starlet who's come to the magical land of Los Angeles and is going to be a big star and everything like that. Now, the reason that she recasts her real girlfriend, who she had killed, Camilla Rhodes, the reason she recasts her as quote-unquote Rita, a girl who has amnesia, is because she still loves Camilla, but there are a lot of things about her that she doesn't love. So the fact that she makes Rita in her dream not know what her identity is and be dependent on Betty means that she gets to have sex with Camilla, she gets to have a relationship with Camilla without all the bad stuff. Because Rita in the dream is very meek and very, she's nothing like the real Camilla. So I think she's trying to separate the two parts out. But this is what she wanted Camilla to be like, but Camilla was not like that. So she kind of recast her as amnesiac, like, oh, it's a blank slate. You know, now I can mold her any way I want to mold her. So that's what was going on there. And the interesting thing, too, about in her dream, she dreams about Adam Kesher, who's a real person, and his identity is not changed from the fantasy portion to the reality portion. But in the fantasy portion, not only does she make him have like a horribly shitty day, like he loses control of his movie and he gets beat up by gangsters and he gets his wife leaves him, is like sleeping with the pool man and all this other kind of stuff. It's because she wants to punish him. Because she perceives that he was the one that took Camilla away from her because they were going to get married. So she's punishing him in her dream. And another thing that she does too in the dream is that she adds the characters of the gangsters and, them having control of the movie and stuff like that. Almost like she's trying to justify why she didn't get movie roles in her real life, because, you know, there's all these power brokers and gangsters were controlling the thing and they didn't want her. So that's probably why they, you know, they had to cast this other woman, you know, they were forced to and all this other kind of stuff. So she's trying to kind of come to terms with the fact that she's like, oh, well, I didn't get parts, not because I'm not a good actress. It's because there were all these like machinations, like behind the scenes, like all these gangsters controlling the stuff and they wanted this other chick. And so it's not my fault. So the whole first portion of the movie is her just trying to recast her entire life and particularly the murder of Camilla, almost like not really trying to sweep it under the rug, but trying to just reestablish what happened, like I said, to kind of lay blame for herself in a way. But the thing about it, though, is that if you watch the fantasy portion of the film, as it goes on, you can see that her sleeping brain is trying to give her hints about what she really did. So it keeps trying to intrude into this fantasy world that she's tried to construct. You know, first of all, there's the scene with Herb and the man behind the diner and stuff like that. Obviously, that's her brain saying, hey, behind the diner, that's the knowledge of what you did and everything like that. But she casts it with different people so she can keep it at arm's length. And as they go on, like as Betty and Rita are doing their investigation and they go to the apartment of another person who's named Diane Selwyn, which is actually her name. So they go to this other and they find a dead woman in the bed that's obviously been there for a few days. So this is Diane's sleeping brain trying to come in and say, hey, you know, you're going to kill yourself, or something, which is what happens at the end of this movie. Spoiler alert. I meant to put at the beginning of this review. I'll put it in the description so you don't. This is going to have like a really lot of spoilers. And also, actually, I would recommend that you watch the movie before you listen to this, because otherwise I'm just going to be babbling and you will have no idea what in the hell I'm talking about. Okay. So I should have said that at the beginning, but I'm saying it now anyway. And like I said, I'll say it in the description so you can read it beforehand. But yeah, spoiler alert. So she does kill herself at the end, but her brain knows all of this stuff. It knows what she did. And so it keeps trying to poke into her dream, like trying to get her to realize what she's done. And, you know, so the same thing happened with the whole scene in Club Silencio and all that other kind of stuff. So, you know, that's why you see in that scene where all the performers, it seems like they're really performing, especially Rebecca Del Rio is in this, and she does a really, really gorgeous a cappella Spanish version of the Roy Orbison song Crying. And it's beautiful. And so that's in there. And it seems like she's really singing, like the look on her face, and she's very passionate, everything like that. But then near the end of the song, she just kind of like drops dead and the music keeps going. So the whole implication of the theater scene is that everything is an illusion. So David Lynch is not only trying to say, you know, it's a film, so it's all an illusion. And he's kind of making a meta statement there too, I think. But he's also, this is also Diane's brain saying, okay, this is the realization. This is, none of this happened. And she opens the purse and sees the blue box, which represents, you know, with the key and everything, that represents the knowledge of what she did that's inside the box, which is why she disappears when the blue box is opened and reality comes back and intrudes again. Now, like I said, I could talk about this for hours and hours, but I won't. I won't bore you or everything like that. But there is a ton of other stuff in this movie. I didn't even talk about the character of the cowboy, who's really kind of really an interesting character who turns up a couple of times. I didn't say anything about a lot of the background stuff, like the color symbolism, the red lampshades, the painting of Beatrice Cenci that's in the background of the aunt's apartment, all the stuff about redheads, all the stuff about Aunt Ruth and where she is and stuff like that. But, you know, this is already longer than most of our other movie reviews, which I knew it would be, because when I get started on this, I'll just kind of go off. But if you are really, really interested in this movie, and like I said, I hope you've already seen it, because otherwise you won't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But if you're really geeky about this movie like I am and want it explained, like they will explain the shit out of it, then go to this site. It's mulholland-drive.net. It's just this huge, and particularly if you go to the home page, there's a link for Alan Shaw's essay. I'll link to it in the description. And it is just, set aside a few hours and just read everything. I was just like, fucking fascinating. I've read this entire site several times, as you can probably tell, because I'm super, super into this movie. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And I really love that, because like I said, a lot of people, you know, I've met a lot of people that don't like David Lynch movies. They don't like surrealism. So they're just like, why can't they just be straightforward? Why does it have to be all this rigmarole? Why all this other kind of stuff? But I love shit like this. I mean, I love the fact that this movie is almost like a really, really complicated book. It's like a really complicated novel. It's like the more, like you see it the first time and you're just kind of like, what? Like everything seems really disjointed. It's like, why are these people changing identities? What the fuck is going on? But the more times you see it, you just pick up like all these little subtle things, all these subtexts and stuff like that. And it's just so, it's so layered and there's just so much going on in here. You know, there's this whole storyline that's going on beneath the surface. And the more times you see it and figure out all his movie references and all his symbolism and stuff like that, it just becomes a richer and richer experience, like every single time you see it. And I just love that. I love movies that have such repeat watchability and stuff like that. You know, I love all of his movies, really, except Dune, which I don't love. I mean, we did a review of that, but that wasn't really his fault. I mean, he wasn't really working from his own stuff. But I pretty much love all his movies. This is very similar, similar kind of structure to Lost Highway, which I also really loved, although I think this is a massive improvement on it. But you can see that this is one of his pet themes and stuff like that. Now, the movie that came out after this one, which actually I think it was his last feature film, was Inland Empire. And that had a similar kind of thing. Now, Inland Empire, I would not necessarily recommend if you're not a David Lynch fan, because if you think Mulholland Drive is inscrutable, then there is no way you will figure Inland Empire out. It is the Lynchiest of all David Lynch movies. It's like 3 hours long, and I haven't even fully figured it. I think I kind of know what's going on, but not really. But it sucks you in, though, even though you're not entirely sure what's going on. It's just some really, really great creepy scenes and stuff like that. But the same kind of thing applies with Mulholland Drive. I actually think, even though it does seem inscrutable on its surface, I actually think it's probably one of his more accessible movies. You know, along with, I guess, Blue Velvet was pretty straightforward. Wild at Heart was pretty straightforward. But this one doesn't seem straightforward at first, but I think it does the more times you see it. So, you know, if you're into Lynch or if you're into just weird movies in general, I would recommend it. And like I said, if you're a dork about it like I am, then just go to this website and read all this stuff, because it's fascinating, like all the theories and stuff that people have come up with. Some of them I think are bullshit, but or are reaching. But a lot of this, there's a lot of really good stuff in there. And like I said, the Alan Shaw essay, I really think he pretty much nailed it. There's a couple little points where I think, well, I don't know if I'd go that far. But on the whole, I think he pretty much got it. And all of the stuff, all of the little pieces that he picks out of the movie and explains, it's very well researched and very well explained, I think. So I think that'll do it for this episode, talking about one of my favorite movies, Mulholland Drive. If you like 13 O'Clock, please remember to like, share, subscribe on all your social media, and also check out our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/13oclockpodcast, if you'd like to support the show. If you don't want to use Patreon, we also have a PayPal account, which you can access by going to our blog at 13oclockpodcast.wordpress.com. And there's a little link in the sidebar that goes to a PayPal account if you would like to support the show that way. Again, thank you all very much for all your support about Tom being away and stuff like that. He should be back the same day that this movie review goes up. And he also really appreciates all the love and support from everybody. And so he should be back for the next episode. So until next time, bye.